Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Psst. Hey, you. Yeah, you. Do you like cracking into curious creatures? Perhaps you ponder the paranormal. Have you ever got a hankering for the haunted? Ever entertain the existence of extraterrestrials? Or have you ever just wanted to hear genuine encounters of any kind? If you have answered yes to any of these questions, then Cryptids, Creeps, and Conspiracy Podcast is right up your alley. So grab your sense of humor and open your mind as we take a journey to uncover the mysteries behind kooky critters, spooky specters, enigmatic entities, and the controversial conspiracies that surround them. Buckle up, because we're going to have a good time.
Today, we bask in the light of mustachioed greatness. Hi, this is Daniel Segura, host of the Mustachioed Podcastio. You like mustaches? You like movies? You like sexy chinganos? Well, the Podcastio is the place for you. We are talking legendary mustaches from Charles Bronson to the Great Burt Reynolds to the OG Ice-T. Find the Mustachioed Podcastio anywhere you listen to podcasts. That is Mustachioed Podcastio.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us again for some brutal, bizarre, and crazy stories with a little side of booze. I hope this is good booze. I hope this is good drink, but I'm not feeling optimistic about it.
It's not for me either.
It's pretty.
Yeah, it looks good, but it's in a metal cup, so
I don't think it's gonna be good. We'll see. What story are you gonna be telling us about?
I'm gonna be talking about some real life zombies.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't like zombies.
These are a little different. Like, it's
They're not the Walking Dead, eat your face.
No, they're not eating
people. And your brains. Okay. Because I don't like those kind of zombies. I don't think I would like zombies anyway, in any shape or form. But
yeah, me either.
Definitely not.
What are you going to be telling us about today?
I am going to be telling you about a serial killer that I hadn't heard of before. So I don't even remember how I found this one, but I went, oh, this is interesting. So to go along with it, I have the Polaroid cocktail. And the reason I chose it is because Polaroids play a factor in the story later. So the Polaroid cocktail is one part of blue curacao, one part vodka, and soda water. Very easy, very basic, which is why I'm terrified that it's probably going to taste like trash, but we'll find out. So the steps are: in a glass full of ice, add the blue curacao and the vodka, and then top with soda water. And then if you have a mint leaf, you can garnish it. Turns out I used all the mint leaf a couple of days ago and forgot to reserve some, and now all the mint is gone, so I don't have a garnish on mine. But it's a gorgeous drink. It's so pretty, but I think it's going to taste terrible.
I think it's going to taste very mediocre.
Oh. So.
All I taste is the curacao, and I don't really like curacao.
All I taste in mine is the soda water, because Apparently, I use too much soda water. And I don't like soda water, so.
Oh, I like it. I mean, I don't like it, but I like bubbles. So it's healthier than drinking a soda.
Yeah, I'm not impressed with the drink. I definitely am not going to ever try that again. I wish that the recipe actually said, like, roughly how much soda water to use. Then maybe I would get the if you want to try this drink, everyone, use the soda water sparingly. I will say that. I think I probably put about 3 parts soda water in comparison, and that was too much. Maybe 4 parts. Too much.
I did about 2 parts.
And but you said all you taste is the blue curacao.
Yeah.
Which is not a great.
I'd rather taste the soda water.
Kind of orangey, but.
But I also used flavored sparkling water that was orange flavor. So maybe that's why it's all I taste.
Probably. Because those two things are orangey.
Yeah.
It's pretty. It's a pretty drink if you like blue drinks.
Yeah.
You want to feel tropical and fancy. Just don't expect it to taste good.
I prefer the taste over the color, though.
Yeah? I don't know.
No, like when I'm making a drink, I don't care what it looks
like.
Yes,
exactly.
I want it to taste good.
Me too. Yeah, I don't. It doesn't have to look pretty as long as it tastes good. Okay, so my story. The guy's name is Robert Berdella. He was born in January of 1949. He lived with his parents and younger brother in Ohio for many years. His younger years were somewhat difficult as he and his brother endured physical and emotional abuse by their father. Robert's father also found fault with him because he wasn't interested in sports. This caused the father to favor his brother and alienate Robert further. So sports and things were really important to dad, and Robert didn't care about sports. So he was like, you know, treated him poorly because of it, which is shitty. I can't imagine, but whatever. The father died suddenly of a heart attack when Robert was almost 17 years old. And when his mother remarried soon after her husband's death, it upset Robert. Robert basically felt that that was, you know, kind of insulting to his dad and, you know, but who wants to be alone? If you meet somebody that you care about, then what does it matter? But Robert didn't like it. He was described as a good student in school with above average grades, but he was bullied by other children. Through all his troubles, he tended to be very isolated from other people, preferring to be on his own most of the time. When he was 16 years old, he watched a movie that would end up being pivotal in his adult behaviors. The movie was called The Collector, and it was about a man who held a woman hostage in his house until she died. Spoiler, Robert took the plot of this movie as an instructional video. So, not good things are going to happen. Which is why it's the brutal story and not the bizarre one. Although he might have been bullied and abused when younger, I definitely don't want to focus on that. He had a hard life, sure, but I mean, he was a monster. And millions of people have hard lives and don't do the horrible shit that he did. So, you know, I'm not saying it was an excuse by any means. I don't like it. But let's get back to the story. After he graduated high school, he moved to Kansas City, Missouri. He began college at the Kansas City Art Institute, but after a year started exhibiting some strange behaviors, namely animal cruelty, which I can tolerate a lot of shit, but leave the animals alone. I just can't, no. Around this time, he also started using and selling drugs as well as abusing alcohol. He was arrested for attempting to sell meth to an undercover police officer. Bad look, don't do that. During his second year of college, he voluntarily withdrew after he was criticized by college administration for something he considered art. He's going to an art school, he does a project, and he's like, this is art, and you have to consider it art. So what was his art project? Killing and cooking a duck. He thought that was artistic, and the college administrators were like, nah, bro, that's not art. We're not buying that. That's not okay. So I don't know why he thought it was art, but he thought it was art. And when they were like, no, that's not okay, so he just quit college after that. After leaving college, he stayed in Kansas City, where he was active in meeting people who, by his standards, might be struggling with their lives. For most of the 1970s, he befriended men who were involved in drugs, sex work, petty crimes, and were runaways. He often allowed them to live in his home with him, as he later claimed he was trying to help them with their problems. He was an openly gay man who was described as flamboyant and civic-minded. So he would invite these people to stay with him out of the goodness of his heart, and his whole like mindset was, oh, they're a runaway, or they're doing, you know, they're doing illegal stuff, and he was, in his mind, I guess, trying to help them.
He was just facilitating it.
Become less, you know, he was trying to get them to stop leading illegal lives, essentially, according to him. He belonged to the Neighborhood Watch program and was even the chairman of the group for several years until he resigned in the mid-1980s. For many years, he worked as a chef in different restaurants and also ran an antique business booth at a local flea market. So he's running an antique business out of like a flea market kind of situation. Eventually, he was only focused on the antique business and he quit working in restaurants. While working at his antique booth, he met another vendor and then eventually met the vendor's son, Jerry Howell. In 1984, Jerry was 19 years old and is believed to be Robert's first victim. There were 6 known victims. Robert's basic pattern was to befriend the victim, drug them, and restrain them in his home. During the time the victim was held captive, he would torture and sexually assault them. There were a lot of details in the research that I was like, I'm not going to talk about that, just because it was gory and nasty and gross, and I didn't want to make everyone listen to the horrible things that he did to his victims. So if you really, really want to know what kind of gross jackass this guy was, you can go find the details and feel free to look that up, but I'm not gonna detail it in this because
what's his name again? I'll look it up right now because I'm curious.
Robert Berdella. So as I said, he would torture them, sexually assault them, and it wasn't enough that he was doing that, but he would keep detailed notes on everything he did to them and what the victim's responses were. So it was like scientific almost for him. He would, you know, drug them and torture them and then write down, this is what I did and this is how they reacted to me electrocuting them. Or I'll give a few details. Some of the victims lived for weeks as his captive while others died fairly quickly. Sometimes they died accidentally. And I say that with quotation marks because the things he did to them were terrible. And they would
look at it, right?
Die from the shit that he did. Other times he purposefully killed them by suffocating them. Once the victim was deceased, he would dismember the body and dispose of most of the body parts in landfills. However, he did keep the heads of two of his victims. One was located in a closet in his home, and the other was buried in the backyard. A few of his favorite methods of torture involved injecting drain cleaner into their vocal cords because it would make them more quiet. So when they were screaming, it wouldn't be so loud.
I understand why you didn't include more details. Oh, that's pretty gruesome. Now I'm looking at it.
He would also electrocute different parts of their bodies, insert needles under the fingernails, break their bones, and inject them with drugs, and use caustic liquids on their eyes.
Do we know how he was getting all these drugs? Like, was he...
No, I don't. But he was arrested years before trying to sell meth. So he had some kind of a
connection.
Yeah. Yeah. One victim had piano wire tied around his wrists in an effort to damage the nerves to his hands. He knew all of his murder victims, some more than others, but they were not strangers to him, except the last kidnapping victim. So he knew these people. They knew him. They were, you know, associates to some degree, friends, people that came to him for help, and then he did this shit to them. Which is, I mean, it's terrible that bad things happened in general, but you don't expect someone that you consider a friend to do these horrible things to you.
That's fucked up.
In March 1988, Robert met Christopher Bryson, who agreed to go home with him. Robert had agreed to pay Christopher for sex. Instead, Christopher was knocked unconscious and then tied to the bed. Robert began some of his usual torture techniques and sexual assaults. Christopher was held for 4 days, but he managed to win some of Robert's trust over that time. On the fourth day, after Robert had left for work, Christopher was able to burn through the ropes that were tying his hands because Robert had accidentally left a book of matches nearby. So Christopher gains his trust and is
like, it's tied to your hands and you're trying to burn it with a match. That probably fucking sucked.
Yeah. But he's like, I got to get out of here.
Yeah. Burns on your hand are better than dying.
Exactly. Exactly. And some of the details will come out. We'll get to that in a minute about how Christopher was able, why he was so anxious to get out. Christopher was able to free himself and jump from the window of the second story bedroom. He was completely naked except for a dog collar. He asked for assistance he jumps out of the house. There is a meter reader, city worker who's walking along reading, you know, meters. I don't know if it was gas or power or what, but it didn't say. It just said it was a meter reader. Who was walking down the street, quickly got Christopher into a house nearby and safe and called the police. Officers quickly responded and Christopher was taken to the hospital after telling officers everything that had happened to him. He also told them that Robert had shown him many pictures, explaining that he wasn't the first victim and that the others were dead because they had misbehaved. So for 4 days, Robert Berdella is showing Christopher Bryson, hey, this is this guy. This is what I did to him. And yeah, it didn't work out and that guy's dead now. So Christopher's like, great. Sooner or later, I'm going to end up dead like these guys and I got to get out of here. So he was, you know, again, burning your hands over the torture that he was enduring. Yeah, and jumping out of a second story window. I'd go for that, yeah. They were, when Robert returned home, he was arrested for the sexual assault and initially denied officers to search his home. However, his permission wasn't needed because they got a search warrant. So they were like, hey, can we search your home? And he goes, no. And they go, we don't care. We got a search warrant anyway. We're just asking to be polite.
Jesus.
They were able to corroborate Christopher's story about where and how he was held captive. They noticed that the bedposts where he had been tied up to the bedpost that he was tied to. The posts themselves were worn down, so it looked like it had been used for that purpose before. Other people had struggled against their bindings to get out, and they were like, great. Around the bed were also the instruments that had been used during the torture sessions. Officers also found hundreds of Polaroid pictures, just like Christopher had said. The pictures not only showed the victims being tortured, some appeared that the victim, at the time the picture was taken, that the victim was actually dead. Parts of the photographer's body could also be seen in many of the pictures. They would later make Robert pose naked in the positions seen in the Polaroids to match him to the pictures that they found. Additionally, during the search, officers found several bones with tool marks on them, two heads in different states of decay or skeletonization, many teeth, one victim's driver's license, various tools used in the dismemberments, and several notebooks with handwritten details of everything that the victims had endured. Because he had to write it all down. And then he kept the books, I'm guessing, so he could review what he did. I don't know. During this investigation, law enforcement realized that Robert had been questioned about the disappearances of two of his victims. He had retained a lawyer in those older missing persons cases without any evidence. There was nothing officers could do at the time. So a couple of his older victims, before this had ever come about, they did question him, but he immediately got an attorney. So they were like, we just know that you knew the victim. But they couldn't do anything because there was nothing, no evidence, nothing. So they just had to let him go on those. However, now they had plenty of evidence, and Robert was initially charged with Christopher's kidnapping and assault. He was eventually charged with one of the murders, and then more followed. In the fall of 1988, Robert pleaded guilty to 6 total murders in exchange for avoiding the death penalty. As part of the plea agreements, he had to testify to the identity of each victim, detailing everything that he had done to the victims and how they each had died. This testimony took several days. He was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, and he died in prison from a heart attack in 1992 at the age of 43. This is a list of his known murder victims: 19-year-old Jerry Howell, 20-year-old Robert Sheldon, 27-year-old Mark Wallace, 25-year-old James Ferris, 23-year-old Todd Stoops, 20-year-old Larry Pearson. There were other people in the Polaroids that could not be identified, but Robert claimed those were those victims that were in those pictures that they didn't identify. He said those victims lived. So the 6 that they got him on, he says those were the only ones that died. But they don't obviously know for sure. So
yeah,
it's possible he had more. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Jesus, that was a gross story.
Yeah. Like I said, I didn't want to go into the... I gave a little bit of the details, but I really glossed over it. I mean, it was gross stuff that he did to them. Super nasty. So.
Well, I don't think this bazaar is going to be much better.
Okay.
It's a new fear unlocked, but...
Oh, wonderful. Let's get into it. As if I don't have enough.
Yes. So, the term zombie has recently been used to describe a dead person who has become infected with some sort of disease that reanimated them and makes them want to feed on human flesh. It's how most of us know the term zombie as.
Right.
While this term has been altered by Hollywood, the true zombies can be found in Haitian folklore. I mean, there's the folklore isn't specific to Haiti. Like, it originated in South Africa, but
okay,
it made its way to Haiti.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
In 1936, in a small Haitian town, screams could be heard. A group of people were sent running when a naked woman stumbled into town. Her eyes were white and glazed over, and a low, guttural growl could be heard.
Ooh.
Sounds like a zombie to me.
I don't like it.
She looked eerily familiar, but no one could put their finger on it. As the town gathered around this woman, a few recognized her, and in fact, they attended her funeral in 1907.
Oh.
Yeah.
So almost 30 years later? Did I do that math right?
The funeral.
Did I hear those numbers? Okay.
Almost to the T, yeah. So the funeral was for Felicia Felix Mentor. The reason everyone was so scared was because zombification is a real practice for voodoo witch doctors. They have basically priests, but the term witch doctor, I don't know if it's politically correct or not, but it makes...
Probably not.
That's what they were. They were like, they practiced voodoo arts and things like that. One reporter caught wind of Felicia and decided to look into this phenomena. Nora Hurston made contact with the witch doctor and asked to see about the zombification process. The doctor created a special mixture of a baby's crushed up skull, a dead toad wrapped in a dead sea worm, and a pufferfish. The pufferfish is the more important part.
Oh.
This was then made into a paste and administered in various different ways, such as eating or putting it on the tip of a blow dart. So you could just get some, a drive-by zombification.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it's used on a living victim. So it doesn't work to like bring people back from the dead.
Okay.
But it turns them into zombies.
Okay.
The person infected by this becomes very ill and passes away. Days later, the person comes back to life. Often, the witch doctor is there waiting for the zombie to help them out of the ground. So they'll just be waiting until the zombification process is finished.
Yeah. They're just camped out.
Yeah. The zombie is very impressionable, and the witch doctor uses this to their advantage to bend the zombie into their will. And the zombies are then often used as slaves. So it's not, they're not out there eating people, but they're just not in their body.
Oh.
After learning about the whole process, Zora went to a sugarcane plantation that was said to have zombie workers. When she arrived, her sources were correct. Several people were shambling around the farm. Their eyes were white and milky, and when she tried to interact with them, they wouldn't even acknowledge her, with some even bumbling into her.
Oh, wow.
So they're just doing their routine, just not even noticing her or anything. Like,
wow.
As she was researching this topic, she became aware of a man named Clervius Narcissi, who was reported a zombie but had managed to escape his corporeal state.
Oh, how did you do that?
So Clervius walked into a hospital with an unknown illness, and all the doctors were stumped. He sat in that hospital for about 3 days before dying. The hospital put him in cold storage for about a day while arrangements were made by his family. He was buried on April 34th, 1962. And
wait
about
a second.
18
24th?
Years...
April what?
April 24th, 1962.
Okay.
And about 18 years later, his sister was approached by a man claiming to be Clervius.
Oh.
The man knew his childhood nickname and intimate family details. He claimed that he was fully conscious for his burial, but was forced out of his coffin several days later. He was given a potent psychedelic called Datura, and forced to work on a sugar plantation until his master passed away.
Oh my God.
A doctor from America became aware of his case, and when his Haitian colleagues called to ask for help about it, because they were the doctors there, and they're like, this guy died, And we remember him dying. We have him on record dying. We buried him. People were at his funeral. And he just walked into town.
Oh.
So he went down there to take some samples of the zombie drug and tested it on lab rats. All the rats went into a comatose state for several days before miraculously coming back to life.
Oh.
Yeah, and that's from the pufferfish. So a man in Japan, I want to say, ate some... Because, like, pufferfish, you can eat them, but they have to be prepared very specifically. Right.
Otherwise, they're
because
poisonous.
Because the poison is in, like, glands. Yeah. And this guy ate some improperly prepared...
Gotcha.
Pufferfish sushi and died and woke up in the morgue.
Nope.
So that, like, something about that just kind of like shuts everything off for a couple days and then you come back. And that was one of the main ingredients in the zombification drug. So it's super weird.
Yeah. Do you know how the rats behaved afterwards?
So that's where the Datura comes in. So once the zombies like come out of the ground, they're in like a confused, fucked up state, but they're given this super potent psychedelic, which kind of like MK Ultra, they were able to like control people's mind with it.
Yikes.
Yeah, because it puts them in like a fucked up state, and then you can just be like, you're going to be pulling sugar cane now. That's like, all you do for 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah, super weird.
I don't want to see
the zombies.
Zombie.
Don't eat your flesh, but it sounds like they're very close to movie zombies.
I mean, maybe if you, when you give them the psychedelic and tell them that that's their new goal is to eat flesh and eat humans, they might.
True.
Instead of pulling sugar cane, hey, you next time you see a person wearing a green shirt, go chew on their arm.
Go eat him.
Yeah. Ooh, I don't like it.
Yeah, not good.
No.
I don't want to be a zombie.
No, me neither.
Do you have a chaser for us?
Oh.
Oh, I said it first.
Okay. So my chaser is a Facebook post that I saw. It's about an animal shelter in Texas. And they had a really fun and unique way to do fundraising for their shelter. And then it also got some cool nice homes for their dogs. So basically what they did was they rented out their dogs for $5 an hour, advertising to adults who were playing Pokemon. And they said, if you are an adult and you want to play Pokemon but not look like you're playing Pokemon, we'll rent you a dog for $5 an hour and it will look like you're just out walking your dog. So no one knows that you're playing a kid's game. And so the results were pretty amazing. They now have a waiting list for people who want to rent the dog to just take it out for a walk. They made so much money in rental fees that they have waived their adoption fees for their dogs. They also found that several people who took the dogs out were posting pictures of themselves with the dog, and then people on social media would see them and then come into the shelter wanting to adopt that specific dog. On at least two occasions, the people walking the dog came back and said, I'm keeping this dog. We had a good time and I'm keeping him. He's now my dog. And they currently have no dogs available to rent. They have adopted out all their dogs, and they're having to bring in dogs from other shelters so that they can rent those dogs out and hopefully get those dogs new homes. And I thought it was super cute.
It is super sweet.
Yeah. What's your chaser?
I've got another watch recommendation. Okay. This time for the movie The Belko Experiment, which I just watched the other night.
Okay.
It's Gina will love it, but oh. It's 80 people get trapped in their office building, and this ominous voice comes over the intercom and was like, okay, you guys need to pick two coworkers that you're going to kill, or we're going to kill four of you. And then they keep upping the number up until like one person is left alive.
Okay.
And it's very, very gory. Like it very almost gory. Made my stomach turn at a couple points.
Oh no.
Yeah. It was really fascinating. Like I enjoyed it.
And I think that there's a lot of people out there who would love to be in that experiment because they have some terrible coworkers and they're like, I nominate these assholes.
Yeah. True. But then
that's why I don't have coworkers. That.
It's creepy.
Yeah, it sounds terrible.
Yeah.
Good I don't want to work in that
horror movie though.
No. All right. I think that wraps us up.
Wraps us up.
Yep. Yeah. All right.
Well, thanks
nice
for joining everybody. Yeah, good chatting with you too. Love you.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey friends, thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.